Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liu, and I'm so glad to be broadcasting live from Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. Today, we're going to be talking about labor in the food system, the often forgotten issue in the good food movement. But before we dive into why the food movement has focused more on the pesticides in your kale than on the people exposed to those pesticides, we're going to bring you a news recap and talk a little bit about some of the biggest food policy stories from the past week. Okay, first up we have some updates about farmers. So New England farmers are worried about who will farm their land after they retire. A new study released this week by the American Farmland Trust and Land for Good found that 30% of New England farmers have plans to retire and leave farming in the next decade. So the majority of these are also farming without a young farmer to support them. So while we see the young farmers movement growing, linking young farmers to retiring farmers and access to capital still remains a major obstacle. Feeding America, one of the biggest anti-hunger organizations, released their yearly update of the Map the Meal Project, which is one of the most interactive and localized maps on hunger that we have seen. They found that every county and congressional district has some level of food insecurity, with the national food rate of insecurity in the U.S. at 15.4%, which is about one in six people. So, by the way, this highlights the importance of feeding programs that aim to close the food gap, like those made possible through CNR, the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act, which we discussed in last week's episode. Moving on, miracle of all miracles, the FDA released its guidance to industry on how to implement a law requiring calorie counts on menus and menu boards at restaurants and retail food establishments with 20 or more outlets. This measure was passed into law as a part of the Affordable Care Act in 2010. That's right, you heard me, 2010. So the release of the FDA's final guidance marks the end of an extremely long and drawn-out process. This law will go into effect starting in early May 2017. I also want to take a moment here and shout out to the New York City Health Department and the former Bloomberg administration, who has been implementing calorie counts on menus since 2008. Way to go, New York. And finally, soda politics is still in the news this week, with Philadelphia Mayor Kenney's proposed tax on sugar-sweetened beverages still getting a lot of attention. This week, Harvard researchers presented a strong case in favor of the tax, predicting that within a few years of the 3 cents an ounce taxes beginning, nearly 2,300 diabetes diagnoses would be prevented and 36,000 people would avoid obesity annually. Over the decade, they predict that there will be close to $200 million saved in health spendings. To champion this initiative, my favorite mayor, which if you guys don't know by now, it's Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and Laura and John Arnold, a billionaire philanthropist couple, have made contributions in support of the $825,000 pro-tax ad campaign that kicks off tomorrow. Buckle up, folks, because if I know Big Beverage, they're not going to take this one lying down. Be sure to tweet to us or direct message us at EatMattersHRN if you would like to include a particular policy update or have thoughts on the ones we discussed today. Now, I want to turn my attention to the issue we're going to be focusing on for this episode, which is the intersection of food, labor, and policy. This intersection is so critical because if you aren't one of the 20 million Americans employed through the food chain, you are, in fact, a daily consumer in the food chain. However, much of the structural inequity faced by food production and restaurant workers has remained largely invisible to the general public. Joining me today to talk about the hands that feed us is Saru Jayaraman. Saru is a co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Center United, or ROC United, and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at UC Berkeley. She's one of the most prominent voices, researchers, and activists working to increase wages and improve working conditions on the restaurant industry for the restaurant industry workers in the U.S. She's also the author of the national bestseller Behind the Kitchen Door and the recently published book Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. When we decided to do a show about fair wages in the restaurant industry, Saru was the first person to come to mind, and I could not be more excited to have this conversation with her. So with that, Saru, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're very, very happy to have you. Okay, so I want to start out by orienting our listeners to the working conditions and experiences of restaurant and food chain workers that you advocate on behalf of every day. So can you help us set the stage and tell us a little bit more about who are the people who work in restaurants that you're fighting for? What roles are we talking about? Front, back of house? How many people does this affect?
Sure.
And then I'll pepper you with more questions in a minute.
Sure. So let's start with the whole food system. As the whole food system is almost 20 million workers. It's one in five private sector workers and one in six all workers. One in six of every worker in the United States works somewhere in the food system. And if you can believe it, more than half of that almost 20 million is in the restaurant industry alone.
Wow.
The restaurant industry is both the second largest employer in the United States economy as a whole and by far the largest employer in the food system. Like I said, it's more than half of all food system workers are in the restaurant industry alone. The restaurant industry is over 11 million workers. One in 12 Americans currently works in the U.S. restaurant industry. One in two of us has worked in the industry at some point in our lifetime,
mm-hmm.
and we actually just made world history. I'm sure you heard this last year, becoming the first nation on Earth in which we're now spending more on eating out than we are on food eaten inside the home. And yet, despite all of that growth and the immense size of the industry, it is by far the absolute lowest paying employer in the United States. So every year, the U.S. Department of Labor puts out a list of the seven lowest paying jobs in America, or the 10 lowest paying jobs in America. And every year, seven of the 10 lowest-paying jobs in America are restaurant jobs. In fact, only one of those seven lowest-paying jobs in America is a fast food occupation. Six of the seven lowest-paying jobs in America are full-service restaurant jobs, the kinds of restaurants we take our families to, we have our business meetings at, or we take our friends to, the kind of places we go to enjoy ourselves are where the poorest workers in America work. And the eighth poorest occupation just above restaurant workers is farm workers. So eight of the 10 lowest paying jobs in America are food jobs, which makes, I like to, when I talk to food justice activists or the food movement, I say, look, you have to understand the food system is not a bad employer. It is the absolute worst employer in the United States.
Yeah.
It is eight of the 10 lowest paying jobs, and seven of the 10 lowest paying jobs in America are in the restaurant industry alone. And so you really have to ask yourself, what does that mean to have the largest and fastest growing sector of our economy proliferating the absolute lowest paying jobs? It means that our industry is almost single-handedly responsible for the fact that right now one in three working Americans lives and works in poverty. And by 2020, some economists predict it will be one in two, half of all working Americans living and working in poverty. Which you then for anybody who cares about creating a sustainable and just food system, if half the nation can't even afford to eat,
right,
let alone eat local, organic, you know, sustainable food, then it's impossible to think about a sustainable food system without sustainable wages and working conditions for the 11 million restaurant workers and the 20 million people throughout the food chain.
So what are some of the current rights of these restaurant workers? And as you mentioned, we're only going to be focusing on restaurant workers for this segment. This is going to be the first in a two-part segment on labor for our listeners. And then next week, we're going to focus more on the agricultural workers and the labor issues that they face every day. But for today, we're going to focus on restaurant workers. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about what their current rights and working conditions are, and how much do they typically earn right now?
Yep. Yeah. So the three issues that we've surveyed about 7,000 or 8,000 workers nationally, and the three issues that continuously come up that have a lot to do with the way the law is right now is incredibly low wages. In fact, the lowest wages of any industry in the United States. Lack of benefits like paid sick days. 90% of restaurant workers report that they don't have a single paid sick day, which means over two-thirds report that they cook, prepare, and serve our meals when they are ill, and then pretty severe racial segregation and discrimination. But on that first piece, the wage issue, I think most people just don't even know how wages work for the restaurant industry. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason that you've got the largest and fastest growing sector of the economy proliferating the absolute lowest paying job is the money, power, and influence of the trade lobby in this industry. The National Restaurant Association, which represents the Fortune 500 chains, is really led by the chains, and which have lobbied vitriolically to keep the minimum wage, especially for workers who earn tips, at $2.13 an hour. That's the current federal minimum wage in 2016 for workers who earn tips.
And $2.
So that incredibly low wage, which is earned by 6 million workers in America out of the 11 million workforce of restaurant workers, 6 million are tipped workers and eligible for this lower minimum wage, which varies by state. But as I said, at the federal level, it's $2.
And so when was the last time that was updated? Sorry to cut you off. When was the last time that was updated?
Okay. So April 1st, this past April 1st, we commemorated the 25th anniversary of the last time that wage went up from $1.85 to $2.13 an hour. 25 years, which means that we actually have workers in our membership. We're an organization of workers, employers, and consumers in the restaurant industry, and we have women in our membership who worked their whole lives at $2.13 an hour and now have grown daughters working in the industry earning exactly what they earned 25 years ago. Two generations of women earning $2.13 an hour, and all because of the money, power, and influence of a trade lobby that usually goes around. The way they've gotten away with paying this low wage is that they paint the picture of a white guy working at a fancy fine dining steakhouse, and they say he's making a ton of money. There's no reason these people should actually get a wage. These are mostly white men. They make a lot of money in tips. But the truth is, the government data shows 70% of tipped workers in America are women. They're disproportionately women of color. They're disproportionately single moms. They're women who work at IHOP and Applebee's and Chili's. That's where the majority of tipped workers work. They're women who suffer from three times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce and use food stamps at double the rate, which means the women who put food on our tables in America can't actually afford to put food on their own family's tables.
So let me see if I got this. We've got a two-tiered wage system that pays workers offensively low rate. I think I can say that. There's no security for these workers these tipped workers, so they can't really plan on how, they don't know how much they're going to take home on every single day, so because they're reliant on tips. And there's no union or structure providing basic worker rights for these millions of people in the industry.
That's right, other than us. That's
other
right.
than you, okay.
We've been the only group leading the fight to change this.
Right.
And as a result, you've got the restaurant industry in the U.S. Becoming the only industry now on earth that gets away with saying we actually shouldn't have to pay our own workers' wages. You, the customers, should pay our workers' wages for us.
Can we?
And
can we step back and apply? I want to know, how did this come to pass? Right. So can we apply a historical lens to these issues, these labor issues? What factors or events in our history influenced these current policies?
Well, it's so funny because for so many years I used to go around, saying $2.13 an hour, these are slave wages.
Yeah.
And I would say it sort of rhetorically, not actually knowing that this whole system originates in slavery. So in actuality, it turns out that tipping did not originate in the United States, it originated in the feudal homes of Europe. So think Downton Abbey, you know, these were aristocratic homes in feudal Europe where a member of the nobility would give a tip to a servant on top of a wage. Okay. And that idea of tipping came to the United States in the 1850s and 1860s when rich Americans traveled to Europe and came back and tried to show off that they knew the rules of Europe. And there was a massive anti-tipping movement so popular and successful that six states in the U.S. passed complete bans on tipping. And In fact, that movement spread to Europe, and the labor movement picked it up in Europe and got rid of tipping, which is why there's very little tipping in Europe now.
Yeah.
And we in the States went in the opposite direction, and the restaurant industry in particular demanded the right to hire newly freed slaves, because this is right after emancipation, and essentially argued that they should not have to pay these black workers anything at all. I mean, after all, they were valueless human beings until emancipation.
Yeah.
And so they should argue that they should not have to pay them anything at all and let them live on customer tips. And that idea was codified into the very first minimum wage law that gave tipped workers the right to a $0 wage from their employer as long as tips brought them to the actual minimum wage. And so we went from a $0 minimum wage in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour in 2016, a $2 increase over almost a century. And it's been a century of a trade lobby essentially continuously arguing that they just shouldn't have to pay these workers' wages.
Okay, so I'm still sort of stuck on the $2, but okay, jumping back to jumping back to where we are now, present day. What are some of the policies in place that directly impact these restaurant workers, and how are you at Rock United working to raise labor standards industry wide?
Yeah, so after many years of being as stuck as you said you were on this idea of a $2 wage,
I can't get my head around
it. You know, we were thinking, God, we just need to make that higher. It just needs to be higher. And then realized that there are seven states in the United States, California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska, that have just actually rejected this whole idea altogether. These seven states for almost 50 years have said, no, this industry has to pay the full minimum wage like every other industry, and tips need to be on top of that. Well, we did research on these seven states and found that they're faring better on every measure than the 43 states with lower wages for tipped workers: higher restaurant sales per capita, higher job growth in the industry, higher job growth among tipped workers, even higher rates of tipping. People tip better in these seven states than they do in the 43 states with lower wages for tipped workers. So we realized that if that could be the way it is in these seven states, then certainly every state and Congress should just get rid of this system altogether. And we launched a campaign called One Fair Wage, calling for the full elimination of the lower wage for tipped workers. And now we have bills moving in multiple New England states, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Hampshire. We have ballot measures that will be on the November ballot in D.C. and Maine, and we are hoping in New York State that Governor Cuomo will move to fix the bill that was just passed that went to 15 as a minimum wage in New York State for everybody except 300,000 tipped workers, mostly women, who were left out of the $15 increase. And we're hoping that that will change in New York State as well. So I think there's lots of momentum. Some of the biggest momentum is at the federal level. Congress introduced three bills proposing the full elimination of the lower wage for tipped workers based on lots of advocacy on our part. And then maybe the most exciting part of all of this is that many, many fabulous restaurant owners have joined forces with us to say we actually believe in getting rid of this antiquated system, maybe most notably Danny Meyer, mm-hmm. who has worked with us and who has gone to completely eliminate tipping altogether in his restaurants and believes in policy that would get rid of the two-tiered wage system. And Andrew Tarlow in Brooklyn similarly, and Tom Colicchio in his restaurants, and lots of other fabulous restaurant owners around the country have worked with us and come together and formed an alternative national restaurant association called RAISE, Restaurants Advancing Industry Standards and Employment. And these 200 restaurant owners, many of them have come with us to Congress and testified in Congress and in state legislatures saying, we actually believe in just getting rid of this system. It doesn't work for workers. It doesn't work for employers. It doesn't work for consumers. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work for any of us. Let's just pay a livable wage to these workers and let tips be on top of that or not at all.
And by livable wage, is that are you referencing the Fight for 15 campaign to raise minimum wage to $15 specifically?
Yeah, so we believe that the minimum wage, and that's what it is, it's a minimum, the mm-hmm. minimum wage should be 15 with tips on top of that.
Okay.
If restaurants like Danny Meyer's choose to go to eliminate tipping altogether, then our advocacy is that they do it in a way that makes their workers whole, meaning that they get everything that they would have gotten with tips now from wages. But in California, for example, California just as a state voted to increase the minimum wage all the way to 15, but tips are still on top of that.
Okay.
Whereas in New York, when everybody went to 15, the tipped workers were left out. And in fact,
right.
tipped workers' wages actually regressed as a part of the $15 bill that just passed in New York. And so we're really hoping that we can work with the governor to fix that.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break to hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, Saru and I will be digging a little bit deeper into the Fight for 15 campaign and what this policy looks like in practice.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you. And what you're listening to is Journey from Limestone. This is by Slow Roasters. We will be right back on Eating Matters.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're speaking with Saru Jayaraman, co-director of Rock United and the Food Labor Research Center at UC Berkeley. Okay, so before we went to break, we started talking about the Fight for 15, which is seemingly one of the most successful minimum wage campaigns to date. So I'm wondering, Saru, if you can kind of speak to the origins a little bit more about this movement for restaurant workers and the way in which the campaign is kind of advocating for these changes that's making it successful.
Yeah, so... So the campaign, Fight for 15, started in New York with fast food workers supported by SEIU, the union, who went on strike just, I would say, at this point, 2 or 3 years ago, calling for $15 in the union. And I think the workers' response surprised everybody, even the sponsors, just the way that workers decided that this really, it was time, things really needed to change.
Mm-hmm.
The way that the strike spread across the country, the way that the demands were bold and unashamedly bold, you know, that they spread internationally, that the actions across the country gained so much energy and momentum, and so many workers came out just, I think, as I said, in a way that surprised even the original organizers. And it just speaks to a moment in which I think we are both seeing the greatest income inequality in the United States ever, you know, in its history, mm-hmm. even higher than the inequality that we experienced in the Gilded Age. That kind of severe inequality, coupled with some real openings and vulnerabilities that we're seeing on the part of the chains and corporate America, where they, you know, they are realizing that they're going to have to make changes to keep their workforce. I mean, we are seeing the greatest labor shortage in our industry, the restaurant industry, that I think this industry has seen in its history. It's an incredibly,
wow.
It's an incredible crisis right now in our industry. Every city that Rock is in, employers are saying, we have never experienced such a labor shortage, and it is because workers just can't survive on the poverty wages that this industry pays anymore.
Right.
So all of those things coupled, you know, we have seen not only bills passed around the country responding to this call for $15, just and just a momentous and historic number of bills passed around the country But we've also seen the greatest rift in the restaurant industry that we've ever seen in 15 years of organizing, in which suddenly this alternative path that we call the high road to profitability, mm-hmm. that's really led by folks like Danny Meyer and Tom Colicchio and Alice Waters and In-N-Out Burger, actually, and Blue Bottle Coffee and Zingerman's Restaurants and so many other mm-hmm. great restaurant companies around the country, who are already paying livable wages and believe that's the only way to run a successful restaurant, we're seeing those folks gain a level of visibility and traction, and they've set a trend that we're seeing so many other restaurants now following. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. And the response of the Restaurant Association is also incredibly different. You know, we've seen editorials in the nation's restaurant news saying, you know what, we're just going to have to deal with the fact that the minimum wage is going up. The industry's not dying, as it's always predicted that industry jobs are going to be lost and menu prices are going to go up. And it just hasn't happened in any of the cities or states that the minimum wage has gone up. And so we're seeing a very, very different response from the Restaurant Association. They're having to respond very, very differently. We even have one local restaurant association that's come out in favor of raising the minimum wage. And so I think it's a very different moment than we've ever seen before. It's like the beginnings of a new way of doing business. That's why the book has come out at kind of right at that moment. That's why we call it a new standard for American dining.
So I want to talk for a moment about your restaurant colors, where you basically walk the talk. So, and by this I mean you pay staff a minimum wage of, was it $9 an hour for tipped employees, and offer benefits such as paid time off and health care. But in a recent New York Times profile, the author wrote that Colors, quote, has not quite proved the point because the restaurant operates at a slight loss. So what do you say in response to opponents of this change who say that this model is not economically viable? I read that article and I wanted you to respond. I want to talk to her about that. What would you say to that?
Well, just to be clear, Colors was never intended to be we're a nonprofit organization, and the point of Colors is actually that it's a training facility. We've trained over 6,000 workers at Colors to move up the ladder into livable wage jobs in this industry. Hundreds of workers come through that place every day mm-hmm. and learn how to be fine dining servers and bartenders. I'm talking about formerly incarcerated people, immigrants, women, people of color. Have gone through and gotten really livable wage fine dining jobs. And so it was never intended to be that. I mean, I think the fact that we're running only at a slight loss, paying much higher wages than most people, and not intending to make profit is pretty good. And I think that wasn't the point. I think the point is much better made by comparable restaurants all over the city, as I said, 200 of them all over the country, that are actually paying just as high wages or some higher than us, and experiencing incredibly high profits, you know, growing at a really rapid rate. And not just the greats like Danny Meyer and Tom Colicchio, who have very, you know, high price menus and very fancy restaurants, mm-hmm. but casual restaurants around New York City, New York State, and the country, smaller mom and pop restaurants. I was just in North Carolina this past week with Vimla, who's the owner of Vimla's Curry Blossom Cafe in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where the wage is $2.13 an hour in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. She pays all of her tipped workers a minimum of, I believe it's 10, and the median wage in the restaurant is more like 15. And there are several workers in the kitchen making $18 and $19 an hour, and she is growing. She is so profitable. She was featured in a Chase commercial. She's often asked to speak at UNC's business school about profitability. I mean, they prove the point, and we don't need to prove the point, because that's not the point of Colors. They prove the point, and they do it much better.
Okay, thank you. I'm just happy that I had you on the air to respond to that. I was like, but I want to know what she would say in response to that. It just kind of ended, right? So, you've been obviously doing this work for quite some time now. I'm wondering, over the course of your career in the fair labor movement, if there's anything that you've reversed or changed your position on, and what caused you to do this. So you mentioned before the move to one fair wage. So is there anything kind of else that you've really changed course on?
I mean, I would say we've matured. You know, we started as a worker organization, and oftentimes as we thought about the key issues I brought up, wages, benefits, racial discrimination, we thought about it from the workers' perspective. And as we became a multi-stakeholder organization with not just workers, but now 200 employers and several thousand consumer members, we're able to see it from employers' perspective as well. And so it's not that we've changed our position, it's that it's much more nuanced. It's not that we think we shouldn't raise wages, it's that we understand that it's hard to do that, and that's why we actually have created a peer support network of employers who can teach each other how to do it, actual training and technical assistance to help restaurants, especially smaller restaurants, learn how they can pay higher wages and provide benefits. We've learned how to accommodate the challenges that restaurant owners experience and still work with them to push towards what needs to be the goal, which is a family-supporting wage and working condition in the industry. Because, look, if there is such a labor shortage going on right now and we have the highest rates of employee turnover of any industry in the United States, paying better wages and working conditions has to be achieved even when it's hard, not just for the sake of the workers who are struggling, but really for the long-term viability of this industry and the long-term, you know, the long-term viability of our dining experience. You know, if we want to have, as consumers, a good dining experience where we feel good about what we're eating and who we're eating it from, who's serving us, and I think we all need change in this industry. So it's been, we've just matured in our approach to how we think about these issues.
Absolutely. Okay, so one final question for you. In your book, Behind the Kitchen Door, you discuss what it means to be a conscious eater and consumer. So for our listeners who haven't had the chance to read your work yet, and if you haven't, I would obviously encourage you to do so, can you offer guidance on how to best engage with food workers on a personal level? Food worker justice. Not just food workers. Food worker justice.
Absolutely. We've created an organization called Diners United, which is a consumer association for people who want to learn more and engage in some way to help change this industry as consumers who are affected by these issues. So you can go to the website of the new book, ForkedTheBook.com. You can find information about Diners United. You can also find an app on there that allows you to know how restaurants are faring on issues of wages, benefits, and promotions, so you know which restaurants are doing it right and which restaurants aren't. Mm-hmm. The book also provides ratings on those issues. But most importantly, everybody eats out and speaks to workers and employers. So for the workers on that website, there's a downloadable little tip card that you can leave in the billfold that drives workers to the website so that they can learn how to learn about their own rights and join the movement. We don't recommend speaking to your server about it because you could get them in trouble. We do mm-hmm. recommend speaking to your favorite restaurant owner about it and saying, we love the food and we love the service and we'd love to see you join the high road. And you can join the ranks of Danny Meyer and Tom Colicchio and Alice Waters and become part of this alternative voice, this alternative trade association RAISE. And we've had a lot of consumers encourage restaurant owners to actually walk away from the old way, the path of the National Restaurant Association, and join the high road. That's how Blue Bottle Coffee joined. That's how Alice Waters joined. I think many more restaurants could join if you as consumers could encourage your favorite restaurant owners to learn how to take the high road.
Okay. I'm going to leave it there for our conversation on food and labor today. Saru, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. For more information on the work that she's engaged in, be sure to check out rockunited.org and pick up a copy of her new book, Forked. Okay. Now it's time for our new segment, the Startup of the Week, featuring... There we go. And with the new segment comes new sound effects. We're really kicking it up a notch here. Okay, our new segment where we feature innovative and exciting new food organizations and companies at the end of each episode. I am now pleased to introduce Mark Oshima, co-founder and chief marketing executive of Aero Farms, an indoor farming startup growing a variety of leafy greens in Newark, New Jersey. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Happy to be here.
Great, happy to have you. Okay, so let's just jump right in. I understand this is a really busy time for you at Aero Farms as you're set to open a new huge headquarters at the end of this month with the lofty goal of creating the largest indoor vertical farm. What is a vertical farm and how does it work?
Sure. Yeah, this is an exciting time for us. We've been growing since 2004, and we're growing indoors. We're actually growing in converted warehouse spaces, and we're here in Newark, New Jersey. We have four different farming operations here. We're actually building out our eighth and ninth farm and what will be the world's largest indoor vertical farm, as well as our new global headquarters. And when we talk about growing indoors, we're growing with aeroponics, so we're misting the roots with nutrients, and we're using LED lights to create the perfect environment for the plants so that they can thrive. And we're thinking about how we optimize the plants for taste, texture, color, nutrition, and yield. And we've been doing this since 2004.
And so the vertical part of it, is this just a way to maximize space in terms of the way you grow? Can you kind of like sketch this out if you've never, for our listeners, if they've never seen like a indoor growing operation?
Exactly. This is really not about a greenhouse on a roof. This is about in a warehouse space. This is about vertical beds of growing, one stacked on top of each other. We're talking about how we can have 75 times more productivity versus the field farm and 10 times more versus a greenhouse. Part of it is around how we optimize the plants. Part of it is around how we optimize the vertical nature of growing. And we're really talking about growing per cubic square foot as opposed to just the square foot. So it's a different way of thinking about farming.
So in an article that I read about your company, the author said that you guys sometimes consider yourself to be more of a technology firm than a farming enterprise. Why is this? And, you know, what are some of the technological advancements that you guys have accomplished since you've been started?
Sure. Yeah, well, first and foremost, we think of ourselves as farmers. We're focusing on the plants and thinking about how we optimize them and really thinking about how we create some really different product differentiation out in the marketplace. But how do we do that? We use technology. So this is definitely a new way of farming. It's horticulture meets engineering meets data science. We've developed all of our own proprietary growing. We like to think of ourselves as the Apple of farming. We've built the hardware, the growing systems, mm-hmm. and we've also built the software, which is also what we call the growing algorithms. And so we've grown over 250 different types of leafy greens and herbs.
So would you say this type of growing is more or less energy efficient from other more traditional methods?
Yeah, we would look very, very closely. And I think one of the things that we really monitor is this is a new way of growing from seed to package. And so we're managing the entire process, creating the perfect environment, and we're really optimizing that. And so we have a very specific lens on energy. We use renewable and alternative energy. We think about how we can be very efficient with LED lights and target the exact spectrum of light that the plants need so we can actually have more effective photosynthesis. Mm-hmm. But this is a way of growing that uses 95% less water, 40% less fertilizer, and zero pesticides. And so we're constantly thinking, we're a mission-driven organization. We're always thinking about the environmental footprint. We're part of the Ellen MacArthur Circular Economy 100, where we think about how do we eliminate waste. And so we're thinking about every aspect of our business about how to be good stewards, you know, for the environment.
What is the company's overall mission, and how do you work to give back to the community in which I operate? Because I understand that's a big part of what drives you guys.
Without question, we're mission-driven. We're thinking about how we can build responsible farms all over the world. We actually have projects in development on four different continents.
Wow.
But what we're really excited about within each community, it's about local jobs. It's about economic development. It's about addressing food deserts. It's about increasing access to healthier foods.
Mm-hmm.
We're here in Newark, New Jersey. One of the exciting things for us that we've been here, we've had a working farm in an inner city school here, Phillips Academy Charter School, for over 5 years. This working farm is actually in their dining hall. It's the shortest farm-to-table experience around. And so when we see the impact we have with the students within the community and creating jobs, we're hiring locally, it's just tremendously exciting for us to be here and be part of that.
Oh, that's great. So where besides the cafeteria at the charter school in Newark can we find your product?
Yeah, so currently we're selling into the local community here within Newark, within northern New Jersey, within the New York metro footprint. We're selling into supermarkets like ShopRite. We're also online at Farmago. We're in the process of ramping up our production and being able to come to market soon to where the consumer is.
Okay, great. All right. So with that, I'm going to wrap it up. But for all of you guys who don't know Aero Farms, be sure to check them out. Mark, can you tell us the website for people to get more information?
Sure, aerofarms.com. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter. Happy to be able to connect, share more about what we're doing.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on today.
All right. Thank you as well.
All right. I want to thank both of our guests one more time, Saru Jaramayan and Mark Oshima, for coming on the show, and for our sponsors for your generous support. Our show is produced with the help of two brilliant people, Taylor Lanzett and Austin Bruniarski. Our music is done by the one and only Tim Archer, and our engineer is the fabulous Jack Inslee. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe, like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook, and find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. I'm Jenna Liut, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.